Welcome back to the show. I'm Dara Kennedy. It's hard to hear that in addition to battling stressors of a global pandemic, that basic needs like food were unattainable for some families. One may ask, how does this happen? Is this legal? Is there a representative that one can call to help the district? But it's likely that residents within those challenged districts may not be legally able to vote. Hence, their voice and their plight is not heard. It's a trickle-down effect, a catch-22, and it's not only happening in Massachusetts.
We've seen states across the country proposing bills and passing laws that will make it harder to vote. But in the face of that, the Vermont legislature has taken an extraordinary step. Over the veto of Governor Phil Scott, they have now passed two bills that will allow legal non-citizens of two Vermont towns to vote in local elections. The two towns are the capital, Montpelier, and Winooski, just outside of Burlington. We spoke with State Representative Hal Colston, who represents Winooski, and was one of the sponsors of the bill that just passed. We asked him if he imagined this would set a precedent for the rest of the state.
It was a time coming for our community. We're the most diverse city in northern New England, and many of those who are immigrants are foreign-born countries that, you know, they fled or needed to move on from, and here they are, and becoming part of our community for years in terms of working, paying taxes, buying homes, sending their kids to school, and can do all of those things that a resident can participate in, but they cannot vote in terms of local elections. And you know, at the city council years ago, we became aware of this, and we just felt that, you know, there's a time for change here.
Do you imagine that this is mostly going to impact people of color living in Montpelier and Winooski?
No, you know, it's interesting. Like I said, we're the most diverse city. Yes, it's going to have a huge impact on people of color here in Winooski, but not so much the same in Montpelier. And I can say maybe in other communities where you may have, you know, a resident who's been around for 20, 25 years, and they do not want to give up their citizenship from their home country, which is certainly their prerogative. So why can't they vote in local elections if they're committed to living here, being a part of the community, paying taxes, and so forth? So it's there's a lot of different stories out there how this will impact people and families, because it's just not the typical immigrant refugee that we picture coming from some African country or Eastern country. It just doesn't all add up that way.
I want to come around to this question of citizenship. One of the perks of being a citizen of the place where you live is that you can vote. And there are people who move here who, after living here for a while, one of the reasons they decide to become a citizen is so that they can vote, because they put down roots and they want to be, you know, involved in their community. What does this do to the concept of citizenship when someone who is not a citizen can then vote, even at just a local level?
It's going to be very interesting to see how this unfolds. In Winooski, we're talking about over 600 people who this will impact. And many of them are on the path to citizenship. You know, it's not a 1-2-3 done deal. It can take 2 to 3 years. It can take 3 to 5 years. It can take 5 to 10 years to get your citizenship. So here folks are in our community living, participating, yet they can't vote. So what's the point in waiting until they get their citizenship? And we have to remind ourselves, for most of the history of our country, we have allowed non-citizens to vote. And it was up until the 1920s when we went through this xenophobic phase in our country, and we just basically cut off immigration. That's when, you know, policies were put in place that we're still experiencing the vestiges of, that are not open and welcoming for people who are not yet citizens to vote. So, you know, we're kind of returning back to, I guess, the pendulum's going back to where it was, where, and there's more and more communities around the country that are taking this on, We took a lot of note from Tacoma Park, Maryland, which has a large refugee immigrant population, and they've been doing this for almost 20 years with no issues. I mean, so it can only, I think, improve local democracy with a small D for the good of all of our community.
What was the debate over this with your fellow legislators like? I have to imagine that some people weren't too thrilled with this idea.
Yeah. Well, the biggest debate was constitutionality. And we saw that at the local level. Once we stood up our Charter Change Commission, which was going to bring together the right people and go out and to really get a feel from the community where we sit on this, we at one point had a meeting at our city council where there was a public forum and people were there to air their thoughts and concerns, and it was really all about constitutionality of this act. And what they couldn't understand and couldn't hear was that this is not a constitutional issue. This is a legislative policy issue, as is dictated by the Vermont Constitution, where the legislature has the power to create and support local elections, not statewide, not general elections. But we can determine who's qualified to vote and to hold offices in local elections. So it's not a constitution. So that we kept running into that over and over again, which is why the Charter Change Commission really sought a strategy to educate our community about what this really means and what this is really about. And then you always hear folks about, you know, well, You become a citizen and then you earn, you know, your privilege to vote. But, you know, I'm sorry, our history doesn't support that. You know, we've allowed so many people to vote who are non-citizens to be part of the community. And especially when people are on that path to become citizens, why not let them practice the full measure of being a citizen? Why is it this, you got to earn this first and then, because you may not earn it. And some people never earn it. If you're in a lottery from India, you'll be 100 years old before you have your turn to become a citizen. So it's a very complicated, you know, issue. It's not just black and white as folks would like to paint it to be. So, and I think it's good for our community to have voices involved who are participating in every which way we can imagine, except they can't vote.
Representative Hal Colston, thank you so much for joining us on And Another Thing. As we've heard, one of the types of elections that non-citizens of Winooski and Montpelier, Vermont can now vote in is for the school board. This could have long-lasting effects on kids in these communities, especially if those kids get their only meal of the day at school. According to the Vermont Agency of Education, around 40% of kids in Vermont are eligible for free and reduced lunch. Well, yesterday, Vermont Business Magazine reported that Heartland Elementary School in Heartland, Vermont, was awarded a $2,450 grant to fight food insecurity among their kids. The money came through New England Dairy's special program for schools called Dairy on the Go. Jill Hussels is a school nutrition specialist in Vermont who works with New England Dairy. She told us that Heartland will be using the money to update their cafeteria equipment.
I know Heartland applied for funding to purchase some commercial quality blenders so that they could offer smoothies, which, you know, are contain milk, yogurt, fruit, really nutrient rich and portable, you know, really nice to be able to offer to kids, especially in the current environment. It can, you know, again, portable, they can offer it in the classroom or in the cafeteria. I feel like this is an unprecedented time where families are relying on programs that do offer food assistance and school meals just, you know, happen to be offering, you know, free meals to kids 18 and under this past year and will be continuing next school year. So I think it's really important for organizations such as ourselves to be able to help support schools in their efforts to help like, feed kids.
Dairy on the Go isn't just focused on Vermont. It's available for all schools in need region-wide. Amanda Aldred is the grants manager for New England Dairy. She helped found the program, which started more than 10 years ago. She tells us that the last year of the pandemic brought about a big shift in the way schools and her program had to reach kids who might be hungry.
Of course, last year was a dramatic shift in need. We spent a lot of the grant dollars helping support remote feeding and the school's efforts to continue to feed students when they weren't in their building. So we helped them purchase a lot of coolers to hold milk and meals at curbside feeding sites, which is, we've done a limited amount of that with summer meal programs. So we've historically helped promote summer meals participation in similar ways, providing coolers so they can keep the meals cold when they're not being served, you know, in the schools where the actual refrigeration equipment is, and then money to help support awareness and marketing of those programs to help, you know, get more students and kids to the sites and locations to participate so that they know that they're there, because that's oftentimes a challenge for schools in the summer or with the remote sites, you know, letting the students know that meals were still available, even though they weren't in the school building. School budgets are notoriously tight, and the margins, if you will, for operating a school nutrition program are not that large. And it can be a challenge to update and purchase new equipment, never mind just replacing the things if they break down. I used to be a food service director, and I believe that some of the equipment in my kitchens was older than I was and still operating. They take amazing care of the equipment that they have in their kitchens because they know it's such a challenge to replace it. So we are very happy to be able to help them add new pieces of equipment to their schools that allow them to expand their programs in the ways that they need and are beneficial for us and our dairy farmer funders as well.
That was Amanda Aldred, Dairy Grants Manager with New England Dairy, who founded the program to help combat food insecurity in schools. And before that, we heard from Jill Hussels, a school nutrition specialist with New England Dairy in Vermont.
Coming up, we hear the results from the Food Insecurity Survey released today on Massachusetts. Stay with us on And Another Thing.
Do you enjoy language and the etymology of words? I'm Emily Brewster. Join me and my Merriam-Webster colleagues, Peter Sokolowski, Ammon Shea, and Neil Servin, as we explore the history of the English language from the dictionary's perspective on Word Matters, a new podcast from Merriam-Webster and New England Public Media, available at nepm.org or wherever you get your podcasts.
Hi, this is Steve Inskeep from NPR News. More than a year ago, we changed everything about how we work so we could stay on the air for you, no matter what. We've kept all this going thanks to colleagues who never give up and listeners who keep giving what they can to support this service. We're there for you because you're here for us. Here's how to give to this station now. Thanks.
Support NEPM now at 800-639-8850 or nepm.org.
Things in this economy might feel like they are starting to get back to normal, but for restaurants that closed during the pandemic, there is a whole lot of catching up to do.
We keep getting hope, and then it feels like it's just out of our grasp.
I'm Kai Rizdahl in New York City, the wine bar that's trying to make ends meet, next time on Marketplace.
That's ahead at 6:30 on NEPM and on your smart speaker. Clear skies tonight, lows in the mid-50s, partly sunny on Friday with highs near 80, and cloudy on Saturday with highs in the lower 80s. You're listening to New England Public Media.
Welcome back to the show. I'm Dara Kennedy. We continue our look into food insecurity in our region. Today, Mass Inc. Polling Group released a study which indicated that 47% of the surveyed Massachusetts families were food challenged over the past year. The data we learned from Rich Parr, director of research for the group, is not only a result of COVID. They collected data from over 10,000 parents in 14 districts from April 9th to May 30th of this year. And the results, well, were unpleasant for many Commonwealth families.
we went out, we talked to parents in 14 different, some of the neediest school districts in Massachusetts, I would say. Out in Western Massachusetts, it was Greenfield, North Adams, Pittsfield, and Chicopee were targets of ours, and we got a good number of responses from those districts. And what we found was some pretty striking levels of food insecurity. We used a six question battery that the U.S. Department of Agriculture uses to measure food insecurity. And basically, if the more questions you answer yes, the more food insecure you are. And we found that overall, it was something like 47% of the respondents were reporting some level of food insecurity. And that range, there was a pretty big range there. So in a couple of districts, it was very, very high. Chelsea and Lawrence, it was, you know, over 60% of those parents that we talked to were telling us that they had some level of food insecurity. But it was also pretty widespread, because in, I would say, 10 of the 14 districts that we talked to, over a third of the parents were telling us that they had some level of food insecurity. So as you said, it's not entirely surprising. We know that food insecurity has been a big issue during COVID, and it makes sense that the districts where we're seeing it worse are actually some of the districts where COVID was worse in the state as well.
Springfield had one of the highest rates of food insecurity in the state among children pre-pandemic. How do we explain that?
Well, I think that, what we have been doing surveys about COVID since the very beginning, not just in school districts, but among all residents. And it really was, you know, you layer COVID on top of all of these other socioeconomic inequities and problems that we know about our society, and it just exacerbated them. It just made them worse. I mean, just to take one, working from home is not available to everybody. So what you're finding is that people who already were doing pretty well were able to stop going into their office and stay at home, and other people who were not doing very well had to go to their jobs, and their jobs were not giving them that option to work from home. And they had to go out there and sort of, you know, deal with COVID. And there's a pretty strong correlation between the places where, between socioeconomic factors, COVID risk, and also these questions of that. So, you know, Springfield is a challenging district.
Based on the survey, the Mass Inc. Polling Group survey, the latest number said about 47% of those surveyed reported food insecurity over the last year, but only about 40% of that group received the benefits from SNAP. What's the disconnect there?
Yeah, that was really the central question of this survey. So we knew that we were likely to encounter food insecurity in these districts. We knew that they were using another benefit that had been provided to them during the pandemic, something called pandemic EBT or PEBT. And that benefit was designed to replace the free and reduced school lunches that kids got when they would be going to class. Well, kids weren't going to class during the pandemic, so the federal government created this program to basically give people an EBT card, basically a card that they could use to buy food in various places. If you already had an EBT card, the money just went automatically onto it, but most people got a separate and new card. And in a lot of these districts, you got that card regardless of your need, because there were enough people in that district who were getting free and reduced lunch, they basically just gave the benefit to everybody. But then when we asked about SNAP, which is the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program, or used to be called food stamps, when we asked about that benefit program, we found that overall only a third of people in the survey were taking advantage of that benefit during the pandemic. I mean, the people in the survey who really needed it the most were not taking full advantage of all of the benefits that were available to them. So why is that, right? And what we found basically is that there's a bit of an information gap going on here. There's some misunderstanding about the eligibility requirements for SNAP. There was a lot of confusion about the application process. People who didn't want to share certain information about themselves. In some communities that had a lot of people who were perhaps not U.S. citizens, people were worried that if they applied for SNAP for their citizen children, if they were a non-citizen, that they could jeopardize their immigration status. But the biggest thing that people were telling us was that they didn't think that they made too much money, that they didn't qualify for this program. About 30% of the people in the survey said that the income cutoffs were higher than they thought they were, which suggests that had they known what their true numbers were, maybe some of those people would have gone out and tried to get the benefit for themselves. So there's a little bit of a misunderstanding about SNAP, a little bit of lack of information about SNAP.
You bring up a good point, though. People think if you have to make less than, in the polling, it said less than $25,000. But give us an example of a salary range or an income range where you would still be qualified that people would be shocked to learn of.
Oh, let me pull one up for you because I have the chart that we used in the survey itself. One second. It varies by the size of your family. And also how much money you make. So for example, if you're a household with four people in it, right? So maybe two parents and two kids, or one parent and three kids, the gross monthly income limit for SNAP, like the cutoff, the maximum amount you can make is 4,417. So multiply that by 12 months, right? And you're getting up into nearly $50,000, and you're still able to get SNAP with that amount. So that's a pretty high number, right? So what we were seeing in the survey was that even people on the lower end of the scale were reporting, saying that they didn't think the SNAP was for them or that they made too much money.
And because of that kind of gray area or gray areas, parents reported not being able to feed their families over the last year. Challenges.
Yeah, that's correct. I mean, exactly. So, I mean, the food insecurity questions have to do with, you know, whether the food that you bought didn't last and you didn't have enough money to get more, if you can afford to eat balanced meals, if you cut the size of your meal or skipped a meal because there wasn't enough food, maybe there was somebody in your household who's not eating as much so that the kids could eat more. We got a really tremendous response on this survey. So we're able to take that data, go to the districts and say, these were the information disconnects that we were seeing among your parents. This is what low-income parents thought versus higher income. This is what Latino parents thought versus white parents. So we're able to really kind of break it down at a pretty granular level and say that these are the places where you can kind of target your outreach. And hopefully that will lead to more people applying and using it.
That was Rich Parr, Director of Research for Mass Inc. Polling Group. If you need assistance, you may call SNAP at the toll-free number 1-800-221-5689. Thanks to all of our guests for joining us this week, and thank you for listening every day. We welcome your comments at 800-639-9120. I'm Dara Kennedy. Thanks for tuning in.
You can follow us on social media. We are at Hello and Another, or email us at andanotherthing@nepm.org. I'm Maya Schwader. We'll see you next week.